All right, so today the first thing I want to talk about is developments of Christianity outside the Roman borders. To the east of the Roman Empire was the Parthian Empire. And you can see it there on the map. Quite a large empire. Some people call it Persian. Kind of is. But the Parthians weren't exactly from Persia proper. You can see Parthia up there on the upper right. Okay, that's their homeland. But it's an empire because they conquered many other territories, as you can see. They were the main rivals to the Romans. Unfortunately, for historians, the Parthians were illiterate. They sometimes used Greek in writing because they didn't write their own language in writing. But, you know, you'll see it on Parthian coins and things like that, Greek writing. But there really are no government documents we can look at or anything, which makes it really sad, okay? And if we're going to study Christian history here, too, we also don't have a lot of information from the early period. Okay? We just have some documents from later on. Makes it difficult. Students of church history are usually very, very familiar with the history of the church in the Roman Empire, and as it gradually developed and moved into Europe, they know all about that. But what they often don't even include in church histories is what's going on to the east of Rome, because Christianity spread there as well, and that always gets ignored. We're not going to do that. Christianity spread into the Parthian Empire just as early as anywhere else. We have less information about it, but it certainly was there. So first thing I want to talk about is some of the legends, because sometimes that's all we've got, about the early period. Not to be completely trusted, though. But here's what some of the legends say. There's a tradition that it was the Apostle Thomas who started Christianity in this region. Now, again, I told you about the Thomas legend, about Thomas traveling to India too, right? Is there any truth to the fact, to the idea that there's a Thomas who goes to the east and preaches? Maybe. All right, but everyone, everywhere, all Christian churches, they want to link themselves to the apostles, so you can understand why they would make something like that up. All right, but it's linked to Thomas. Now, the best known and most widely disseminated legend of this tradition says that Thomas was the first to evangelize in that area, and then after him came a fellow by the name of Adai. And Adai was supposedly one of the 70. It's a group I didn't tell you about, but there's a tradition, I think it comes from Luke, actually, where Jesus got 70 disciples together to go out and preach while he was still alive. I believe this is mentioned in Luke. And Adai supposedly was one of the 70. That's the legend, that he was one of the 70. And that he in turn had two disciples, one of whom was named Mari, I've got him up there, and another named Agai. He was a guy. A-G-G-A-I. So Thomas, and then Adai, and then Agai and Mari, three generations there, legends associated with their preaching Christianity in this area. All right? Now, we've also got a tradition that's connected with this that comes from Eusebius, and you read it already. It's in Book 1 of Eusebius, and in it he says, and maybe you read the story, and I don't remember that in any of the Gospels, because it's not. Okay? And in fact, Eusebius has the earliest version of this legend. And it is that, well, let me show you. He's actually even got excerpts from letters and everything, like a letter from Jesus and so on. And he says that there was a king of Edessa. And Edessa is a city, well, you can see it there on the far western side of the Parthian Empire. See that city, Edessa, there near Asia Minor? Okay? The king of Edessa, by the name of Abgar Uchama, he calls him, Abgar Uchama, that he was interested in Christianity, and he had heard about it Let me find the exact section here. Yeah, story about the Prince of Edessa. Okay, Eusebius connects it with Thaddeus, who is listed as one of the 12 in the Gospels. So it says here that Jesus sent Thaddeus there when King Abgar, the brilliantly successful monarch of the people of Mesopotamia, who was dying from a terrible physical disorder which no human power could heal, heard continual mention of the name of Jesus. So he's asking Jesus to come heal him, but Jesus does not go. Instead, Thaddeus goes, and Thaddeus is sent by Thomas. All right? And then Thaddeus goes and heals the guy, and that makes him want to convert to Christianity. And apparently here, Eusebius has got an actual letter from Abgar to Jesus, and then he's got a letter from Jesus to Abgar. This is the earliest version of the story. We do not know the story any time earlier than Eusebius, which is in the 300s, and so we don't really give it much credence, okay? An actual letter of Jesus, you know, it seems pretty far-fetched. But here's the thing. Thaddeus is to be equated with Adai. Eusebius probably heard about the legend of Adai because we have similar legends just like this one with Adai as the main character, not Thaddeus. So we believe that Eusebius probably heard about the story of Adai and he says, wait a minute, who's he? I never heard of him before. And connects it instead with Thaddeus, a known character from the Gospels, whose name is, well, maybe somewhat similar. Okay, where did this legend come from? Well, from what we can tell, there actually was a king of Edessa by the name of Abgar who did convert to Christianity, but he wasn't the Abgar that Eusebius is saying it is. If Eusebius is correct, the ruler Abgar would be Abgar V, who was a contemporary of Jesus. But the real story is about Abgar VIII. He reigned 177 to 212. Okay? That is more likely. And that he, in fact, did hear about the Christian message, converted. We have records of this happening. Not contemporary. They're from a little bit later. But we have records of about Abgar VIII converting to Christianity. Okay? And he's actually going to be associated with Bardaisan of Edessa at the bottom. I'll get to him in a few minutes. Okay? Edessa was the capital of a smaller country that was in between the Roman Empire and the Parthian Empire in the 1st-2nd century. Okay? And that state was called Osroene. It was a small little country. So Abgar would have been like the king of that whole country. All right? But it was very small. And it didn't last long because the Parthians will take it. All right? So what happened was, a story about Abgar VIII got retrojected to Abgar V. So it made it seem like it was from the time of Jesus, but in fact it was not. However, we probably can accept the story that Abgar VIII, from the late 2nd century, early 3rd century, he probably did convert to Christianity. Mari is said to have been a disciple of Adai, and it said that Mari set up the church at Seleucus Ctesiphon as the main church of the Parthian Empire. Now, we're going to talk about this later, but if you see, there actually started out as two cities. You can see them there, right in Babylonia. Seleucia and Ctesiphon, right next to each other, they're going to combine into one city, and that's going to be the center of Christianity in a couple hundred years. And the legend there is that Mari is the guy who set up that city as the chief city for the Christians there. Again, probably not true. All right, because that would put it really, really, really early. All right, so those are some of the key figures in the legends of the East. Now, what about the reality? It's possible, actually, that the seeds of the Eastern Church were sown fairly early. We have mentioned in the book of Acts, which you read, at the very beginning when Peter is preaching to everyone, they mentioned that among the ones converting to Christianity there were Parthians, and then some other Mesopotamians are mentioned, like Medes and Elamites and people like that, all living in this area. Now, the Gospel of Luke was written around 80 or 90, somewhere in there. So that could suggest to us that already by Luke's time, there were Parthians who were Christians. Now, these particular ones in the story of in Acts of the Apostles were Jews to begin with. Well, there were Jews there, okay? And they may have gone to Jerusalem for Pentecost, and so, therefore, it's possible that some converted to Christianity. All right? That's our earliest reference to people from this territory. We know that the church of Antioch, which was a major center for Christianity, you can see it on the map. It's in the Roman Empire, though. See, Antioch, right to the, right on the far left edge there. That was a mother church for missions to the east. And this is kind of important because then you know that this brand of Christianity that was being practiced at Antioch is going to be the source of the Christianity for the east. All right, their brand of Christianity will be very similar to the to that which was practiced at Antioch. Now, the center, though, of the church in the east, outside of the Roman Empire, was Edessa. Was this before or after Abgar the Eighth? Probably after. All right, but right around his time, it probably became a very, very important center for Christianity. And for sure, there were Christians before Abgar the Eighth in that city. It's not far from Antioch. All right, but it will become the center for this brand of Christianity. We call it Syriac Christianity. Does anyone know what Syriac is? It is a language. Okay, Syriac is a language. It's actually a form of Aramaic. I've told you about Aramaic before, right? Syriac is Aramaic, basically. It just has a different script. It looks a little like Arabic, okay? But it's Aramaic. The churches of the East, this was their main language. All the Parthian churches, Aramaic. Their services were held in Aramaic. Which is interesting because, remember, this is the original language of Jesus. All right? So we call it sometimes the Syriac church. Edessa will be the center for the church in the early years. After a new city kind of becomes the center for Christianity in Parthia, and that is the city of Arbela. And you can see Arbela right over here. It's to the east of Edessa, a little bit south. You see it there, Arbela? So that'll be the new center for Christianity in the Parthian Empire. Later on, it's going to move to Seleucia Ctesiphon. I told you that about that already, but that's not yet. Very probably, the first Christian congregations emerged in this empire from Jewish communities. Now, why do we say that? Judaism had already been present in Mesopotamia. We know that they are there, okay? And ever since the Babylonian exile, though, there have been Jewish communities in Mesopotamia. All right? And merchants were constantly traveling from Mesopotamia to the west, into the Roman Empire, up into the Levant and Asia Minor. And many of these merchants were actually Jewish. All right? So we have Jewish merchants going back and forth. We believe that as they were traveling from Mesopotamia into the West, some of them would have been exposed to Christianity and became converts, Jewish Christians. And then when they went back into Mesopotamia, they spread the message. So among Jewish communities in Mesopotamia, that's where you start having Christian churches pop up. All right? And Edessa had a significant position on the trade route, by the way. People were going through Edessa all the time, and Antioch as well. So usually along trade routes is where messages spread, and that's often how religion gets disseminated. An additional factor contributing to the development of Christianity there was constant deportations out of the Roman Empire and into the East. People would get banished, you know, whenever they would get in trouble or whatever. And I told you already, Christians were sometimes getting in trouble with the government, and sometimes they would be deported instead of executed. So they go into Parthia And at the time, during this period, Parthia was pretty open about Christianity, so it was allowed to develop there a little more easily than in the Roman Empire. So that contributed to it as well. Now, I got to tell you about this man named Bardason of Edessa. He was a poet, a philosopher, an astrologer. All right, he was very wealthy, had pagan parents, and he himself was a pagan, okay, which the Parthians generally were. But he ended up converting to Christianity. We believe that he even was educated in the court of Abgar the Eighth. He's actually a contemporary of Abgar the Eighth. But then he left Edessa, and he went and studied philosophy in certain places. He learned all about Babylonian astrology, they say, and that's where when he became an astrologer. He's very interested in the stars and all that. And then when he converted to Christianity, it is said that he brought a number of his ideas about astrology into Christianity, because he himself was a Christian teacher. And he wrote many works. And in those works, he incorporates Babylonian, I guess you want to call it pseudo-astronomy, because in this period it isn't really astronomy, it's astrology. Okay. So he was friends with Abgar the Eighth, and Abgar the Eighth actually gave him a position in his court. And this is before, of course, the Parthians took Edessa. All right. But as a result, we believe that it probably was Bardason who was the one who converted Abgar the Eighth. All right. And the two of them helped spread Christianity in Edessa. So the legend got, you know, changed so that it was Adai who did it, and it was Abgar the Fifth. But originally, it was probably Bardason and Abgar the Eighth. There are writings about Bardason in the Roman world, and they have a lot of nasty things to say about him, call him a heretic, and so on and so forth. But he apparently was a pretty important person in Parthia. He got the job of presbyter, never a bishop, but he was a presbyter in Hierapolis. Is that in there? Don't see it there. It's also known by the name of Mabug, but I don't see that there either. But it's in Parthia. I think it was a small place. So he was an important Christian preacher in Parthia in the very early period, and one that we could actually say he was real. Okay. Sometimes, because the Roman Christians don't understand him very much, they call him a Gnostic, but he very much was not one, and he actually wrote works against Gnosticism, and he actually wrote things against Marcion. He hated Marcion, he hated Valentinus, so he was not a Gnostic. All right. Okay, so those are some important early figures in the East. We're moving on now to the next generation here. I call it a period of speculation, simply because during this period, a lot of new ideas are coming out. Well, we've kind of seen a lot already, but particularly during this period, people are starting to speculate theologically about all these interesting, deep topics, all right, and trying to find answers. So we're going to see quite a bit of that. But before we actually get into the speculation part, I want to talk a little bit about church buildings. Remember, I told you that the early churches were in people's houses. They didn't have the money to build buildings. And sometimes they wanted to hide, you know, from the authorities, so you don't want to make a big spectacle of it. So church buildings weren't around early on. All right. Writing just prior to the year 200, Clement of Alexandria, now this is a different Clement, not Clement of Rome, who we talked about before. This is a guy named Clement of Alexandria, whom I'm going to talk about actually probably next time. He gives some interesting insights into evolving Christian social practices and worship. And in this quote that I'm going to read for you, he actually gives the first usage of the phrase going to church, meaning it's a place now, right? Before, church, ecclesia, was just a group of people, and that's how they spoke of the word. He's the first one to talk about it as a place. Church is somewhere that you go. Now here's what he says. Women and men, interesting that he says women and men, should go to church decently attired, with natural step, clinging to silence, possessing genuine love, being pure in body and pure in heart, and fit to offer prayers to God. All the more, a woman should observe the following. Let her be completely veiled, unless she happens to be at home. In some Christian communities, veiling was common practice for women. In others, no. There's not a prevailing practice here, but it is here. Okay, and he's writing from Alexandria, Egypt. He says, for the Logos, Jesus, okay, wishes this, seeing that it is fitting for her to pray veiled. Those dedicated to Christ ought to present and shape themselves throughout life in the same manner as they fashion themselves with propriety in the churches. They ought thus to be, and not just seem to be, gentle, pious, and loving. And yet I know how they change their dress and manners with their location, just like an octopus. Indeed, after their departure thence from the church, laying aside the inspiration of the assembly, these people become just like the masses with whom they associate. He's complaining that people dress up real nice for church, and then when they leave church, then they, you know, wear what everyone else is wearing. He doesn't like that. Okay, they should dress nicely all the time. Already we're seeing, like, patterns of dress and behavior for church. It's kind of interesting. Nowadays, you just think, oh, that's normal. But this is the first time we're actually kind of seeing it, where someone's actually talking about looking nice when you go to church. And he wants you to look nice all the time. But women wearing veils while praying and things like that. His complaints betray a concern over outside influences. We're going to be seeing this more and more. Like, you don't want to be like everybody else. And when the secular world influences you, it's not for the good. But again, he's talking about church as a building, a place to go. Or, I mean, it could still be a house. I mean, it doesn't say it's a building. It says it could be a house church. But it's now a place. I even told you about Justin Martyr, who said that they used to meet above the baths, okay? Their church at Rome, not above the bathhouse. Still not a church, okay? But things are changing now. And one of the things that makes you want to have a church building is too many people to fit into the house. So the group gets too big, there's no room. So you need someplace bigger than somebody's house. And only rich people have really big houses, so that's one of the motivations for getting a building, all right? But also, you kind of want to be able to set up your place of worship so it has certain accoutrements and articles and utensils and art so that it, you know, permanent. Because if you have to kind of set up everything every time someone comes over, it's kind of a pain. But if you have a place where you can have it already set up and ready to go, that's much more convenient. So that would be another motivation. What they probably did at first was actually keep the place, the house that they were worshiping in, but just the people who lived in it moved out, and they just made it into a church, right? So it's still in a residential place, but you can change the home, knock out a couple walls or whatever, and make it into a church, okay? And the one I'm going to show you in a minute is a perfect example of that. But then they're going to also start building brand new buildings as well. Well, let me show you this one. This is our earliest excavated church. It's at Dura Europos, which is actually in Parthia. Not very far into Parthia, but it's on near the western side. But it's in Parthia. Actually, I'll show it to you on the map here. Dura Europos. You see it's in Mesopotamia on the far west, on the left there. Dura Europos. See it? That's where it is. Okay. This is our earliest found church building. All right? It was an ordinary house originally, but it was converted into a church. Okay? Interestingly, at the same time they found this church here at Dura Europos, they also found a Jewish synagogue from the same time period. We believe this church was built somewhere in the 240s. By the way, the synagogue was also a house converted into a synagogue. That's interesting too. But here we've got an artist reconstruction of the building and what it looked like. And it doesn't look like a house so much anymore because they rearranged it and they made it for church use. But it tells us a little bit about these church buildings that they now have. By the way, Dura Europos was It was in Parthia for a lot of the time period we're talking about, but it was also for a short time part of Rome, and we know there was a Roman garrison held there, and it may be that when the church was built, it actually was under Roman control, although quickly, shortly thereafter, it would be under Parthian control. The assembly hall on the left side there, that's where everyone met, okay? There aren't enough seats for very many people. You can only fit maybe a dozen or two dozen people on these benches that they had in there. Does that mean there was only a couple dozen people that would go to church? Probably not. The theory is that they sat on mats. And that's why on that picture you have a bunch of people on the floor sitting on mats. So we believe that a lot of people sat on the mats, and maybe the important church leaders or the rich people sat on the benches. Okay? And everyone else sat on the floor. But you can only fit in there about 75 people. So these are not huge congregations here. All right? They're still relatively small, but too many to fit into a house. We also believe that they separated men and women from each other. So that's an even more reason for like not having not as much room, because you have to keep the men and the women on opposite sides of the room. Okay. That other room, room F there, could be the room that maybe women, you know, worshipped in, but the artist here feels it might have been some kind of a Sunday school. Okay. I think that's anachronistic, but that's why he has it in quotes. But one of the most interesting parts is E, which is the baptismal font. And that's what they have a picture of there on the left. That's where they had baptisms. Okay? And there's a little, it's hard to see it there, but there's a little tub, okay, under that arch that you can be baptized in. It's actually about as deep as a tub, which raises the question, like, how are you going to get somebody under the water? Because it's, you know, it's like it comes up to, like, your knees. It's possible. I mean, you can get down in there. You know, people do go into the bathtub that way. But some people think that maybe it's an indication that, at least in this particular church, they didn't totally dunk you anymore. Maybe they just poured water on you or even sprinkled. Okay? But we don't know for sure. But it's interesting. It's like it's the oldest baptismal pool that we've got. It's two stories, by the way, this building, but we, of course, don't have the second story anymore, so we're not exactly sure what would be up there. Clement of Alexandria, whom I was just reading, he discusses the fact, that he believed that the church place was a sacred area, and it should be treated in a sacred way. So already there's an attitude here about the place of worship, that it is holy. You know, when you're meeting in somebody's house, you can't really say that so much, because I'm sure, like, when people left, they'll just go back to normal. It's not really a sacred place, okay? But now that you have a special church building, okay, a place that's only for church meetings, now you can start calling it sacred or holy. We also see evidence here, because there's more people meeting, all right, that the Eucharist seems to have been fully separated now from the fellowship meal. There's no place to eat here. Okay? We know they did practice the Eucharist in church. All right? But it's hard to have an agape feast here without any place to eat. Okay? There's no tables or anything left from this church. So we believe that the agape feast is pretty much not really practiced here in church. Just the Eucharist. Now, they may have had these agape feasts in people's homes on other occasions, but in this actual church building, there doesn't seem to be any evidence of their having one. Okay. At one end of the Christian assembly hall here, there is a raised platform, so that suggests that there would be a person standing on it who spoke and who read from the scriptures or whatever. We also, and you can see a little bit of it here in the picture on the left, there are scenes from the Gospels on the wall. But here's an interesting fact. Did I tell you about this guy Tatian, who was a student of Justin Martyr? He's mentioned in Eusebius too. I believe I told you that he took the four Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John and combined them into one big Gospel in chronological order. Did I tell you this? And he had to make some edits and stuff to make them all fit together. But the pictures on the wall reflect his version of the Gospels, the combined version. So that tells you something. Maybe Tatian's Diatessaron, it's called, his Diatessaron. Maybe I should give you the name of it. Maybe that was read in the church. It will not be the popular version used in most churches, but maybe it was here. I guess that's it on that. Now, I've got another church to show you from very early. This one was only recently found at Megiddo, which is, it's not on the map. Okay, well, it's in Israel now, okay? But it's way over here. Well, it'll be between Jerusalem and Damascus, okay? Megiddo. We call this the Armageddon Church. Because Armageddon, I don't know if you know, this is from the name Megiddo. It comes from Megiddo. In November of 2005, it was announced that excavations at a high-security prison there, there's a Megiddo prison, brought to light this, what you see there. Okay, something on the ground. Big mosaics, a floor of a building. All right? It was an early Christian place of worship. And there are Greek inscriptions on it and everything. And it's not, clearly was not a big basilica-style church or anything like that. Actually, it doesn't resemble any church buildings that we know of. It's not like Dura Europis either. It seems to have been a room within a larger residential building. In other words, kind of like a chapel inside a bigger complex. Now, what's interesting is what this complex was. It was a housing unit for a Roman legion. Okay? So there's a big complex there where a legion of the Roman troops was living. All right? And is it legion was living or legion were living? I don't know. But anyway, and this was their church, their little chapel there for worship. And it's clearly Christian. You can see the fish symbols there, which are Christian, but also the Greek inscriptions tell us that it is as well. And I'll tell you what they say in a second. So some kind of prayer hall or something like that. The potsherds that we've discovered on, I say we, like I was there, I was an archaeologist. The potsherds are dated to the 3rd century, so right around the time where we are now. A few of them to the 4th century. In the northern wing of the building, this is not in the actual church part, there are some material remains also from the 3rd and early 4th century. There are coins ranging from the 2nd to the 4th century. That helps you date things. All the coins, though, found in the Christian meeting room date to the 2nd and 3rd centuries only, not the 4th. We believe that maybe the church was closed after the 3rd century. When the legion was moved out of there. And we actually have documentary evidence that the legion was moved out of that area in the late 3rd century. So that could explain it. So this is a very early church. It's competing with Dura Europis, although people still think Dura Europis is the earliest. But this would have been made not long after that. Now, what about the inscriptions? The largest one we call the Gaianus inscription because it mentions a guy named Gaianus. Okay, and it says, Gaianus, also called Porphyrius, centurion, our brother, has made the pavement at his own expense as an act of liberality. Brutius has carried out the work. So it's like a dedicatory inscription telling you who made the building. Okay, who paid for it and who built it. It's typical inscription for epigraphs that you put on buildings or whatever to... You know, nothing unusual about it. But here is the interesting thing. Calls him our brother. Okay? Suggesting some kind of maybe Christian association here. Although, I will say that the language of brotherhood was used elsewhere too. It doesn't have to be Christian. However, other things we found there confirm that it is Christian, like the fish and another inscription I'm going to read in a second. Okay? Another inscription is called the Akeptus inscription because it's named after a woman. Should I write these down? They're really not for you to remember, but for your notes. Okay, so Gaianus, all right, and Akeptus. And that's a woman. Here's what hers says. Very interesting. The God-loving Akeptus has offered the table to God, Jesus Christ, as a memorial. Now, here's the interesting thing. All three words, God, Jesus, Christ, are written as sacred names. They're abbreviated and there's a line placed above them, so that suggests that the whole name is one name. God, Jesus, Christ. Now, this is interesting for, well, a couple reasons. One reason is, here Jesus Christ is clearly referred to as God. We don't see that often in this early period. The earliest person that refers to Jesus Christ as God, God, Jesus Christ, is Ignatius. But even he, that seems to have been in a minority. Not a lot of people are calling Jesus God yet. Okay, there are a few other examples as well. But here we have it right on the church floor. Okay, some people have made a big deal out of this, saying, oh, see, Dan Brown in the Da Vinci Code was wrong, because in the Da Vinci Code he says that no one called Jesus God until after Constantine. But, yeah, of course Dan Brown is wrong. Everyone knew he's wrong even before they found this church, okay? Yes, Jesus was called God by certain Christians prior to Constantine. The Gnostics did, and Ignatius, and a couple other. I mean, it doesn't mean everyone thought he was God, because there were different Christologies out there, all right? But lots of people in the Christian community did call Jesus God before Constantine. So it's not a big revelation. Akeptus apparently was a woman of financial means, because she donated the table, okay? And the table probably was used for serving the Eucharist. So we know the Eucharist was celebrated here too. And again, we believe that it is evidence that the Eucharist was not celebrated in conjunction with an agape feast. The table was not big enough for everyone to sit around. It's a table just to keep the stuff on it, you know? It's like this, okay? It wouldn't have been a big table everyone sat at. And then there's a third inscription that's not as important, but it's called the women inscription. It says, remember Primilla and Syriaca and Dorothea, and moreover also Christe. That's all it says. Now, what is it? It is probably, we're not positive, but probably a list of women who had been martyred. Why else, like, say, remember these women's names? We believe, and we're going to see this beginning in the 3rd century, people are really placing a lot of emphasis on the martyrs. These must have been women that used to go to that church who had been martyred. And they are being remembered in an inscription. Oh, and I don't really have that much to say about this, but I should tell you, just for the sake of being comprehensive here and fair, that in Jordan, there's a place called Rehob, there is, if you go there, They have a big sign that says that this is the earliest church ever found. Okay. There are lots of archaeological sites where people have signs up that tell you that it's something really special and famous, where it isn't necessarily. Okay. As far as I know, no archaeologist, you know, respectable archaeologist actually thinks this is the oldest church ever found. But I wanted to tell you about it. It's kind of cool because it's in a cave. It's actually underneath another ancient church, but this church was from Byzantine times, all right? But they found a cave underneath it, all right, that they think is much older. But we don't even know if this was actually a place where people worshiped. There is a cave under the church, and there are places to sit, like a couple of benches, but nothing where, I mean, there's nothing else really that tells us that it is a place of worship. And plus, we aren't positive when it was constructed. So, but I wanted to tell you about it, that there is this cave chapel there, and they claim, you know, the people who are in charge of the site, that it is, they actually say it's from the 1st century, okay, which is quite an exaggeration, all right, and I don't think it should be taken that seriously, but anyway, wanted to show you the cave. Okay, a fundamental question for any Christian in this period was, how do you connect with God and receive His grace? Remember what grace is? A favor shown to you even though you don't deserve it. But how do you get it? It's kind of funny, like it's supposed to be undeserved, but people are always asking, well, how do I deserve it? So this was a question here. Now, increasingly, the early church started moving in the direction of saying, well, it's the sacraments that connect you with God. That's how you get His grace. Sacraments. You know what a sacrament is? Have I used this word before? Sacrament. What's a sacrament? Well, yes, that's an example of one. Absolutely. The Eucharist, baptism is one too. These are religious ceremonies, rituals or acts, that is somehow an outward or visible sign of an inward or spiritual condition. Okay? But it's also a vehicle for encounter with the divine. So by participating in the ritual, you are somehow being connected or drawn to God. Now, even today, people are divided, even in churches today, over what the true nature of a sacrament is. So we don't agree today. We probably didn't agree very much back then either. And part of the confusion stems from the early church use of the word. Different churches use it differently, so that's the trouble. Okay? But they use the word sacramentum, which is Latin, for these acts. And in Greek, they use the word mysterium, mystery, for it. Which, by the way, think about what we were talking about in Greco-Roman thinking, the mysteries, remember? It's the same word, okay? But it's something, you know how in the mysteries, in the Greco-Roman mysteries, you have to engage in certain rituals, and it's very similar. We're going to focus on baptism, though, only right now. In the church of this period, baptism was clearly the central and culminating rite of Christian initiation. Justin Martyr, and slightly later than him, Clement of Alexandria, said that baptism was enlightenment. Kind of like, it's the time when the lights go on. All right. Justin said that it was also a time of regeneration. And what did he mean by regeneration? He means like being born again. But I don't want to use it in the born again. This has a loaded connotation here. But actually being born a second time. There were people writing around this time period that says that you are saved through water, they would say. Meaning baptism somehow saves you. Okay? A later theologian from about maybe 100 years later will say that you get God's grace by being baptized. So becoming very important for the receival of God's grace, for getting God's favor. All right. However, faith is not separated from it. It's not just a ritual. It's supposed to be an outward sign of what's going on the inside. But more and more, it's considered absolutely essential. Okay, it's not just a cool thing we do. You have to do it, or else you're not going to make it. The thing is, even though I say that faith is, you know, baptism is supposed to represent faith, more and more, faith was expressed as a creed or as a rule of faith, I should say by this point, a rule of faith. So it's more about, you know, affirmations of doctrine than it is kind of like your own belief, all right? Although you would say you believed all that. So that's why at baptism they would ask you questions like, do you believe this? Do you believe that? Yes, I do, I do. Okay, then you're baptized. So that's how they check your faith, you know. So because of this belief that there is no salvation without baptism, people began to get worried about their family members. Okay? For example, what happens to, you know, little Maggie? Is she going to be saved? Because she's a little kid, you know, should she get baptized? Because we believe that in the early days it was adults that were baptized. You got baptized when you chose to become a Christian. All right? But now that is for salvation purposes. Now you got to think about everybody else. And another group that people were worried about. What about all the old faithful men like Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and all these famous men who died before Jesus even came, and there wasn't any baptism? What about them? So that's another issue. Tertullian gives this example. He says, in the age before Jesus, faith without baptism was enough. Okay, but now it's not. Another guy, Hermas, he wrote The Shepherd. He wasn't quite as nimble as Tertullian. He just said that the Old Testament saints got baptized after death. Okay, so they had different answers for this question, but it was an issue. What about martyrs? There was also the question, let's say someone is a catechumen. They're studying to be a Christian. but they get martyred before they get baptized. Are they saved? And the answer was, of course they are. They're baptized in their own blood. So, but because baptism is such a salvation issue now, that's why all these questions come up. Another thing that was a problem with this was, it was believed that baptism cleansed you of your sins, right? What happens when you sin after you get baptized? Now you're in trouble. Now, if they're just little sins, it's not a big deal. Okay? But what if you do something big, like you murder somebody or you commit adultery or whatever? Then what? Well, they had to come up with another ritual, and it's called penance. We'll talk about penance later on, where you have to obtain forgiveness again for your sins. But the point I want to bring up here is that many people decided to delay their baptism because they want to make sure that all their sins are out of the way first. Right? So you have like, we even have examples of people getting baptized just before they die. Okay? But you have to be careful because what if you die first, right? You never know. So you don't want to die first. You got to be baptized first. But a lot of people would hold off as long as they could. Augustine, who lives a little bit later, he said that his mom would let him become baptized as a kid because she was worried about the sins he might commit. And then we have the Emperor Constantine, who got baptized on his deathbed. Okay, so that happened as well. So it's kind of ironic that we have both infant baptism and late baptism result as a consequence of these ideas. Baptism was always understood as a kind of washing, right? Cleansing for the remission of sins. As a rebirth, so a lot of times it's likened to being born again, coming out of the womb. And because of that latter focus, sometimes the nakedness of it would be stressed. For example, there was a bishop of Jerusalem, his name was Cyril. By the way, Jerusalem will become again a pretty important city in the eastern side of the empire, for Christians anyway. Remember I told you the Jews were forbidden from it, but there was a Christian church there. Anyway, Cyril of Jerusalem stressed the naked dimension of baptism when he talked about how baptism is similar to Adam, the first man, being made out of the dust of the ground. Okay, and he came out naked. And we have actually other references to baptism being practiced naked. And they use the word naked. And sometimes it's likened to resurrection. So you're like coming out of the tomb. And how are you coming out of the tomb? Not with any clothes on, that's for sure. Okay? How are you coming out of the womb when you're born? Naked. So now the question is, were people actually baptized stark naked? Because if they were, it would be no problem with regard to men. But remember, by this point, only the clergy, the leaders of the church, could actually baptize people. So who baptized the ladies? See, in Christianity at this point, they were very, you know, strict about sexual matters. All right, and they would have thought of it as inappropriate, wouldn't they, to baptize women naked, a man baptizing a naked lady? This doesn't seem to go with their other beliefs. Now, Tertullian, and we're going to talk about a little bit more about him today, he was from North Africa, another famous Christian bishop of this time. He emphatically denied the right of women to baptize women, okay, and said baptism is strictly a masculine function, so you can't really come up with the idea that, well, women baptize women. It probably did not happen that way. In fact, a few decades later, another bishop denounced a woman who baptized somebody and said she was the agent of a most wicked demon for baptizing somebody else. All right. So the vehemence of that language and the frequency of it show that it was very unlikely that women actually baptized anybody by this time. Okay. One document giving some comprehensive discussion of the matter is a 3rd century work, and it's nothing you need to remember, but it's called the Didascalia
Apostolorum.
And it's, well, basically has to do with teaching of the apostles. Everybody loves to claim that their teaching comes from the apostles. But it has a discussion there of the need to have deaconesses. There can still be deaconesses, by the way, in this period. Deacons, you know, are just like the lowlier servants, but they're of the church, but they're a little higher than the regular people. They do have women deacons still at this point. Anyway, it says that you should have deaconesses anoint the women with oil prior to the baptism, because it says it's not fitting that that women should be seen by men. But what does that suggest? Suggests that they were naked when oil was put on them prior to the baptism, but if men do the baptizing, then didn't they put something on then? It makes it very clear in there that the deaconesses are only supposed to anoint and not to baptize. Okay, so it comes down to this word, naked. Gymnos is the word. It could indicate being in your undergarments, not completely naked. In other words, they sometimes use the word naked very loosely to refer to someone just wearing their underwear, okay, or something very scanty. So some people have suggested that that's a possibility. Perhaps it's actually that they weren't totally naked. They had some kind of small garment on, but they still call it naked because it's pretty close. Okay. But another possibility is simply this. Maybe they baptized naked women. Maybe that's what happened in those days. And they tried to keep it all chaste and everything, but it is possible. In fact, we actually have, I couldn't find a picture of it, and I wish I could have because it would have been interesting. We actually have a depiction, a 4th century depiction, of a naked girl, presumably pre-adolescent. She looks kind of young, but she's a girl, and she's being baptized by two men, and one of the men has priestly robes on, so he's clearly a priest. That seems to be an indication that maybe, well, these girls, if not women, were baptized naked in some places. Okay? So anyway, that's the conundrum. I don't have a direct answer for you, but that's kind of one of the situations we wonder about. Okay. Baptism in the apostolic tradition of Hippolytus. Hippolytus is a character we're going to talk about more, but he was a fellow from Rome, important Christian figure there, the church there. And he wrote a book called, he wrote a few books, but he wrote one called The Apostolic Tradition. Again, trying to liken what he's talking about to coming from the apostles. But he's got the very first full description of what baptism is like and how to do it. Okay, he goes through like the preparation for the baptism, the baptism proper, and then what you do after the baptism. I'm going to talk about all that right now. But it's the earliest that we have of a full representation of exactly the procedure of baptism. Prior to this, we just have, and then they baptize so-and-so. Or they'll have a little bit of a discussion about one aspect of baptism, but that's it. So we don't have a lot of information. It's doubtful whether this complexity that we see here in Hippolytus' work goes all the way back. It was probably much simpler earlier on. But this is our earliest representation of it. Okay? The way he presents it, and this does not seem to be the earlier practice, he says there's a 3-year apprenticeship of training and instruction. That's the norm here, before you can get baptized. All right? So you want to become a Christian? You have to go through training. And the trainees are called, as you know, I think I told you already, catechumens. Did I tell you about the catechumens before? Well, catechumens are those in training to be Christians. Okay? According to him, they have to be catechumens for 3 years. Catechism is the actual instruction that the catechumens get. I did tell you about this before, now I remember, because I told you about the catechetical school in Alexandria, which was a school built to train catechumens. I don't know about built, but formed. Okay, I don't think they had a separate school building at this time, but formed. So catechism is the instruction for these new people, and catechumens are the trainees, the apprentices. So it's obviously very important in this period that you know exactly what you're getting into before you actually get baptized, and you know a lot about Christianity before you get baptized. I mean, 3 years, it's like, you know, going to college, okay, just to become a Christian. So quite a lot of training. A long list of restrictions is given by Hippolytus about certain classes of people that are not allowed to be enrolled as catechumens. Actors, charioteers, soldiers who might kill people. I mean, if you're a soldier in like a civilian post, that's different, but if you might kill somebody, no. Civic magistrates, eunuchs, diviners, men with concubines, and there's a few others, but those are some interesting ones on the list. Okay? In other words, if you're in one of those classes, you're not allowed to be a Christian. You're going to have to get a different job or something like that. Okay? But you can see at this point, there is a definite prejudice against the military. And against, and a lot of these professions are actually looked down upon by typical Roman people anyway, like actors they tended to look down upon, and eunuchs, okay? Diviners, that would be a more of a Jewish and Christian thing, okay? Men with concubines, already at this point, you know, marriage is the way to go. So it's kind of interesting. The document also displays a concern about the maintenance of social and sexual order, and they want to know right off the bat at the beginning. Hippolytus says you have to figure out, now, is this person a slave, for example? You got to know first before, because if he is a slave, you have to get permission from his master for him to enter the school. And is the person single or married? They're single, especially single men, but I guess we go for both, that they have to be warned, you better abstain from any kind of impurity, okay? You got to either maintain celibacy or you're going to have to get married, all right? But no fooling around. So they get screened, so that's interesting. All right, now, penultimate preparation for baptism. That means like the last thing you do before you actually get baptized. So after the 3 years of instruction are over, then you have to go through the final stages here. The first thing you need to do is be examined, okay, by the screening committee, whether you've been living a decent life through all this period. Is there anything that you've been doing in your personal life that would not look good from a Christian point of view that could have an effect? And they want to see that you've done positive things, like have you gone to visit the sick? Have you helped out any widows lately? You know, things like that. So they have to be active in good deeds. All right, this is a very serious matter. I guess the what's really of concern to them is they want to see that a conversion has taken place. Are you a different person than you were when you started? Okay, that means that the Christianity has been affecting you the way it should. Then they had to go for several days before the baptism. Every day they had to go through these exorcism rites. They were very scared of demons in those days, and every day they performed these exorcisms on them to shoo away the demons. On the last Thursday before the baptism, there would be a special private bathing, okay? Then a fasting on Friday, and then on Saturday, a final exorcism. It's kind of interesting what he says here about the final exorcism. He says, "The bishop shall assemble them and command them to kneel in prayer, and laying his hand upon them, he shall exorcise all evil spirits to flee away and never to return. When he has done this, he shall breathe in their faces, seal their foreheads, ears, and noses, and then raise them up." This is kind of interesting. What is the point of sealing up their ears and noses? Well, the forehead, that's a different kind of seal. You have to put a mark on it, but sealing up the ears and the noses. Anyone know why that might be important here? No. That's a good guess, though. Like, got to make sure they're not going to drown. And so the evil spirits can't get in. That's right. That was commonly thought that evil spirits got in through your ears, nose, or mouth, and so you have to be very careful. Okay, but like I said, there's a heightened sense of the demons in this period, and they wanted to make sure that all forces of evil were completely dislodged from a person so that they could be ready for the Holy Spirit at baptism. Then they had to spend the night, Saturday night, in vigil, listening to readings and instructions and so on and so forth, and then they would get baptized on Sunday. So here's how the baptism went. First, at the crack of dawn, they have to consecrate the holy waters and the baptismal tank. All right, and then it says they have to take off their clothes. All right, and he uses the word naked. They're naked. Then they're going to be consecrated with oil. Demons were given a final blow here too. Each candidate, as they entered the water, they had to say the words, "I renounce you, Satan, and all your servants and all your works." Then the presbyter, assisted by a deacon, would administer a threefold baptism. Now, this is interesting. We already saw, just a little bit earlier than this, how they began to ask the questions about, do you believe such and such? Do you believe such and such? And they had it in the three-part series about the Father and about the Son and about the Holy Spirit. Now, they've already got a threefold baptism. In other words, they go under the water three times. Okay, once for the Father, once for the Son, once for the Holy Spirit. And then there was a final anointing, okay, with oil. Now, post-baptismal rites, and this is interesting because this, you might think this is pretty elaborate. This is nothing compared to what would be like later. You know, in a couple hundred years, it's going to be quite a ritual, okay? But here, there still are things you have to do afterward. After you got dried off and put your clothes back on and you went back into the church, the candidates had prayer, okay, and the bishop would lay his hands on them while they were praying. There would be a signing on the forehead, usually the sign, well, in later times it would be the sign of the cross. I think they're still not using the cross yet as a symbol in this period, but some kind of sign. I'm not exactly sure what sign they would be using. Then there would be an acceptance from the rest of the congregation who all would give them the kiss of peace. The kiss of peace had become part of the liturgy during this period where you go up and kiss everybody, but it was had a liturgical function. It's not just, you know, showing affection, but there's a principle to it. Catechumens were not allowed to participate in the kiss of peace because they're not yet in the congregation. So, but once you're baptized, you can. And then they'd have the Eucharist. And then there apparently was some post-baptismal instruction. Now, the apostolic tradition can't be used to explain the theology and practice of the early church everywhere, because we've already seen, as we read documents from different regions, they have slightly different practices, well, sometimes very different practices. But it does give us a little window into what it was like around Rome, the city of Rome, in the time of Hippolytus. Okay. Scholars generally are of the opinion that in the first century or two, baptism involved primarily adult converts. All right, you wanted to become a Christian, you got baptized, but you had to be old enough to make that decision. Whether there were exceptions to that basic pattern, well, there's some debate about that. When was the first baby ever baptized? I don't know if we'll ever know. Okay, but it wasn't common in the early centuries. However, there was strong communal identity involving a sense of the whole family. And sometimes we do even have in the New Testament, it'll say a household got baptized. So some people have made the claim, well, household, that must mean everybody in the family, including the kids. Could be, you know, but it's not proof, but it's possible, you know. But nothing explicit, okay? And I will say that, too, in Justin Martyr, you know, from the second century, he contrasts in one of his works the lack of choice at birth with the choice that one exercises when he gets baptized, suggesting that, at least in his region, infants lack choice and therefore didn't get baptized. Okay? But whatever its beginnings might be, infant baptism is becoming a more frequent practice in this period. Hippolytus actually bears witness to this in his work. He says, "First baptize the little ones. If they can speak for themselves, they shall do so. If not, their parents or other relatives shall speak for them." So in his time, they're already doing it in Rome. Okay. And Tertullian also gives evidence of it being practiced in North Africa. Now, the evidence for the emergence of this infant baptism provokes the question, why did the church embrace the practice? And I think I kind of hinted at this before when I said, well, as baptism became more and more crucial to salvation, people became worried about their kids. And babies died all the time in those days. Are they going to go to heaven? So parents probably wanted to baptize their babies so that they would be able to be saved. Okay? There were certain explanations for why you should baptize infants that begin to be written during this period, but we believe actually the practice predated the theology. In other words, they started doing it before they actually came up with explanations for why they should do it. All right? Probably at the instigation of parents. But still, even as late as the 4th century, we do find children in Christian families not being baptized. So it's not a universal practice yet. Okay? There are families that they wait for the kids to grow up before they choose to get baptized. And I also told you that there were people who even waited until near the end of their life to get baptized. It depends on kind of where you stand on the issue, and people had different points of view. All right. I'm out of time.